When we think about the threat posed by North Korea, we tend to narrowly talk about the missiles and nuclear weapons that are inside North Korea. But North Korea is also a prolific international arms dealer, and its weapon systems have appeared in conflict zones across the world. But other than the occasional news stories about a boatload of North Korean guns in the Caribbean and gas masks that were headed towards Syria being intercepted on the high seas, media coverage of North Korea's arms sales abroad has been scant. And when public attention comes short, it runs the risk of getting left behind in diplomatic negotiations. Our guest today has done a comprehensive study of North Korea's arms sales in the Middle East and Africa in particular, and believes that Pyongyang's global arms sales activities have implications for both the effectiveness of our sanctions policy towards North Korea and Pyongyang's own ability to make its weapons program more deadly. From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., I'm your host, Yang Kwon. And this is Korean Context. We're joined today by Dr. Bruce Bechtel, professor of political science at Angelo State University. He is the author and/or editor of 6 books to date, including The Last Days of Kim Jong-il, The North Korean Threat in a Changing Era, and Confronting Security Challenges in the Korean Peninsula. His newest book, North Korean Military Proliferation in the Middle East and Africa, was just published from the University Press of Kentucky. Dr. Bechtel, thank you for joining us on Korean Context.
Thanks for having me.
To start, why now? Was there an event or development that led you down this research path?
I've been doing the research and the writing on this book for more than 4 years now. I wrote a journal article in 2009 that talked about North Korean proliferation to the Middle East and South Asia. And that article was received well, but, you know, received well in the academic community means a few hundred scholars read it and forgot about it, and that's that, right? Well, as I started watching the news and seeing the civil war erupt in Syria, and nobody was talking about North Korea, I started to realize somebody needs to research this and write about it, because even government officials were not testifying about North Korean involvement in the Syrian civil war. That led to me putting in a proposal for a grant from a private endowment where I studied military proliferation, arms sales essentially, in the Middle East, all of the Middle East, and Africa. And I found that they were quite extensive. So this book, I expected it to take me 2 years to research and write it. It took me about 4.
One of the most interesting aspects of your book is the description of how deep and long the relationship is between North Korea's military-industrial complex and its client governments in Syria, Iran, and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. For instance, you note that the relationship between North Korea and Syria go back as far as the 1970s, the Yom Kippur War. Was the United States government aware of this during the Cold War?
That wasn't exactly a secret. Remember, the Cold War, there were countries that acted as proxies for the Soviet Union, such as Cuba and Angola, places like that, and North Korea. So sometimes the Cubans and the North Koreans were both supporting a state or a non-state actor that the Soviet Union wanted to back. But in the case of Syria, it was open. It was known. I mean, you could watch it on CBS News. That actually began before the 1970s. That relationship began around 1967. And Kim Il-sung and Assad, the dad, met many times, and North Korean troops and North Korean military units were helping Syria basically from 1967 on in one way or another throughout the Cold War. The relationship with Iran didn't really begin until the theocratic movement began. So North Korea's relationship with Iran started around 1980 and continued throughout the Iran-Iraq War, and then just kept on blossoming after that war was over. So that's one. The relationships with African countries are very strange. For example, some of them are quite interesting. If you look at Angola, for example, the North Korean relationship started off with North Korean Special Operations Forces troops supporting Angolan rebels, if you want to call them that. It was a civil war that was going on there at the time, in the late 70s, early 80s. The side that they supported essentially won, not so much by combat, but by default. And so they just stayed and kept selling stuff to what was then the de facto legitimate government of Angola. And there was states that were formed in Africa in the 1960s that in the 1970s, as the Soviet Union started to support them against us, the Americans, the North Koreans were right there. And so when the Cold War ended, then the North Koreans just kept the same relationship. It went from being a here, have this rifle to now you have to pay for the rifle kind of thing, because the Soviet Union was no longer subsidizing North Korea, and therefore North Korea was no longer going to subsidize these African countries, but they would sell them stuff.
If we were aware of these events, and it sounds like they were quite explicit and open during the Cold War, were we not attentive to this in the 1990s? Why did we kind of forget about North Korea's relationship with these countries?
Well, that's a good point. As I said, it wasn't really a secret. Some of this stuff may have been classified in the beginning. But the 1990s was a time, essentially, where the Cold War was over and the United States essentially ignored Africa, most of Africa. The same thing went for the Middle East. We were paying attention to Iraq a lot. We were paying attention to a lot of things in the Middle East. We were not paying a lot of attention to Syria. We were paying attention to Iran, but that was almost exclusively their nuclear program. Because we had so many other priorities, it's my guess, this is just a guess, that the U.S. government just wasn't looking closely at North Korean proliferation. I mean, I'm sure a lot of guys in briefing rooms were saying things like, well, who cares about a few rifles? Well, now there are hundreds of thousands of rifles. They're not just a few rifles anymore. And it's also tanks and trucks and rocket-propelled grenades and artillery and machine guns and on and on and on and on. And North Korea has built this into quite a profitable endeavor.
What is most perhaps dangerous to global security is, of course, North Korea's proliferation of ballistic missiles and scuds and nuclear fissile materials.
Mm-hmm.
If you could bring me to understanding where North Korea acquired this technology, was it all from the Soviet Union? How did this industrial military complex begin, and how did this export program begin?
Well, it's a long laundry list of stuff when you're talking about WMD. North Korea got their plutonium program from the Russians, the Soviet Union. The Russians built for them a 5-megawatt plutonium reactor, an experimental reactor. It's not hooked up to anything. If the North Koreans are saying, well, we need this for power, well, there's nothing hooked up to it. That's Yongbyon, obviously. So that's how they got their plutonium program. The way that evolved into ballistic missiles, which then evolved into a highly enriched uranium program, is rather interesting. They got their first Scuds from the Egyptians in around 1979. They then turned that around and started manufacturing Scuds on their own. And in the 1990s, they built what you know as the Nodong, which is really just a really, really long Scud, essentially. It's a missile that has a range of up to 1,500 kilometers, which means it can hit Tokyo, etc. In 1993, the North Koreans formally tested the Nodong for the first time for outside members. They invited Pakistan and Iran to observe a test of the Nodong, and they flew it over Japan, which Japan didn't realize until a couple of years later, by the way. And this is all in unclassified sources. When the missile test was completed, the Pakistanis and the Iranians both agreed to buy the missile. Both Iran and Pakistan also set up fabrication facilities. A better way of putting that was the North Koreans set up those fabrication facilities for them. Now, Iran had plenty of oil and thus plenty of cash. Pakistan didn't have plenty of anything. Pakistan's a very poor country. So a lot of the deal for Pakistan to get those Nodongs, which they wanted because they wanted to strike India with them, part of that deal, a big part, was to simply trade highly enriched uranium technology and centrifuges for Nodong missiles. Throughout the late 1990s and the early 2000s, up until late 2002, American-made C-130s, which the Pakistani Air Force has, were flying centrifuges through China, refueling in China, and then landing at Sunan Airport, which, as you know, is the Dulles of Pyongyang. Then the North Koreans would put a Nodong back on the C-130, and they would fly it back to Charawaba Airport outside of Islamabad, and there you go. This trade went on for several years, basically until the United States went to the Pakistanis and said, stop. So literally the way that North Korea got their highly enriched uranium nuclear program was by building missiles that somebody else wanted and then trading those missiles for technology that they had not, as to that date, possessed before. So that's how the whole thing evolved.
So it's more important than just making money. It means more to the North Koreans. It's a way of also acquiring new technologies, new capacity.
Certainly in that case it was. And they've done similar things, but that's the most striking because obviously the HEU program is quite a threat.
Going back, you mentioned that North Korea acquired its first Scud from Egypt. Presumably, there are other countries out there whose military-industrial complex is capable of developing Scuds if they've had a longstanding relationship with the Soviet Union. What made North Korea so special? Why is it not an Egyptian military-industrial complex that's potentially exporting ballistic missiles? What was it about North Korea that made them a...
I mean, you would think that, right? But, you know, you always see these new weapon systems tested in Iran, for example, and they always call them indigenous systems and blah, blah, blah. Iran does not develop anything that I know of. Any missile they got, they either got from the North Koreans or the Chinese or somebody else. But most of their liquid fuel missiles, the vast majority of them, they got from North Korea. They do not have a military industrial complex that develops things purely on its own. I don't know why. The Egyptians are the same way. They have not really developed anything except something that's been built for them by the North Koreans, which is typically something the North Koreans have copied from somebody else. What we call the Musudan is nothing more than a old Soviet SSN-6 liquid fuel missile, a medium-range ballistic missile that used to be fired out of a submarine. Well, at the time they got it, way back in the 90s, the North Koreans didn't have any submarines that could fire a missile that big, or a missile at all, as far as I know. So the North Koreans converted that to a land missile, and then they made it a little bit longer. So it's not that the North Koreans just take these things and copy them. They usually embellish on them, and you know what they're making is a little bit different. So the North Koreans essentially will take something that somebody has already given them or that they've bought from somebody or that they've stolen from somebody, and then they'll turn that in, they'll make that system their own, and then they'll deploy it against the South Koreans, obviously, and more importantly, or just as importantly, they'll start proliferating it to needy customers.
I think there's an interesting story there. What do you mean by stolen it? So far, all these transfers have been through transfers from Soviet Union, acquisitions from Egypt. Is there an instance that you can tell us about the technology theft?
Well, there's a couple that come to mind. The Musudan missile originally was an SSN-6, right? The Russians didn't give the SSN-6 to the North Koreans. Reportedly, the North Koreans bribed some rogue Russian scientists to get a complete, intact SSN-6 down to North Korea. And they smuggle it in. Next thing you know, they're building the Musudan. Another example is what the North Koreans are calling the Hwasong-12, which they've now tested several times. The Hwasong-12 has a range of about 4,500 kilometers and can easily hit Guam, where we have U.S. citizens. So very important stuff. And we have the strike aircraft that would attack North Korea with strategic weapons on Guam, too. So it's important to the North Koreans. It came out a few months later that the engine that was in there looked a lot like a RD, as in Romeo Delta 250 engine, that's manufactured in the Ukraine. But when the Ukrainians were asked about this by newspaper reporters, the Ukrainians said, we did not ever sell the North Koreans these engines. Never, never, never. And it also turns out that North Koreans had tried to smuggle some blueprints for those engines or for some engines out of Ukraine. And in fact, the guy who was doing it is in prison right now in the Ukraine, North Korean guy. North Koreans are always out there stealing technology. Sometimes it's easy to detect. What are you going to do with a missile engine except put it on a missile, right? You're not going to put it in your car. But the big problem with the North Koreans is a lot of the dual-use stuff that goes into technology for weapons, especially missiles. Stuff from Japan, stuff from the United States even, that they use. It is a constant fight for the North Koreans to acquire stuff where they can and how they can, and they are very clever. I'm not going to say North Koreans are smarter than Iranians or, you know, any of that stuff, because that wouldn't be true, obviously. But the North Koreans are very clever about building all kinds of things with very little open access to technology and very little money.
I think we could turn to maybe the second half of the title of your book, to Africa. You noted that the question in sub-Saharan Africa is not who is buying weapons from North Korea, but who is not buying weapons from North Korea. Mm-hmm. Here, we're talking more about conventional arms and training programs like you mentioned before. But how and why did these relationships develop in the first place? And why is it important for us to keep our eyes on Africa when it's not, you know, weapons of mass destruction?
Mm-hmm. As I said earlier, some of these relationships started because North Korea was already involved with these countries militarily during the Cold War as a proxy of the Soviet Union. The relationship evolved. It went from the Soviet Union paying for everything to cash and carry between the North Koreans and these guys. And sometimes barter stuff. I read almost every year about some sub-Saharan African country or another that's bartering something for weapons with the North Koreans. Diamonds, for example, in Angola. Nuclear material, yellow cake, from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. They do this for obvious reasons. A lot of these countries just don't have a lot of hard currency. Some of them do, and countries like Namibia, for example, has been paying between 2000 and 2016, according to the Rail Uniform Services Institute, a British think tank, $311 million. That's just one country. They're not making as much money in Africa as they are in the Middle East, but they're making enough that by North Korean standards, it helps Kim Jong-un take care of the elite. It helps weapons development programs, goes into his slush fund, etc. But there's another thing that's very important. One has to understand that several of these countries in Africa, Mozambique, Ethiopia, Angola, the DRC, Sudan, Somalia, a lot of these countries in Africa, the way they built up their militaries was around a Soviet infrastructure, Soviet weapons, Soviet-style training, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the Cold War ended, and that just poof, went away, right? But that didn't – their need for weapons and refurbishment of weapons and training for their troops did not go away. The Soviet Union went away. Well, who could step into that void and fill it for them? The North Koreans. Not only could they step in and do that for them, they could step in and do that for them for cheaper than anybody else. And that's how a lot of these countries ended up working with North Korea. Something that we've seen in the past 3 or 4 years, I love reading the UN panel of experts reports, because they'll go in Uganda, for example, and ask them, are you still buying weapons from the North Koreans? Oh, no, no, no. Then the UN panel of experts guys will conduct an investigation last year, for example, where they found out North Korean pilots were training Ugandan pilots, right? And so they went back to the Ugandans and said, what about this? Oh, yeah, we forgot about that. So, I mean, literally, that's how it goes all over Africa. The United States, as you know, has never particularly interested in what's going on there, hasn't given any of those countries a hard time about it. Like pulled aid or anything like that, because we give foreign aid to a lot of those countries. And so they've just done it. And now they're starting to realize, one hopes, that they can't do this anymore. Sanctions are real, and they have to abide by them.
You mentioned that we haven't really done much yet in Africa, mm-hmm. but what efforts have we done so far globally to kind of constrain their conventional arms sales?
Well, let's talk about Africa for a bit. I mean, we have done some things in the past year. For example, Sudan has imported a lot of weapons from North Korea over the past 3 years, obviously using these weapons on their own people, on their rebels, just like the Syrians are doing. The UN and the United States were going to lift some of the sanctions on Sudan because things have calmed down over there. But Sudan was still buying weapons from the North Koreans. So the United States informed them that if you stop, we'll lift the sanctions, some of them. They stopped. At least they told us they stopped. And we lifted some of the sanctions. Well, guess what? The UN panel of experts report is coming out and Sudan is buying weapons from the North Koreans again. So I'm sure we'll get the same answer the United States will. Oops, you mean those weapons? Oh, okay, yeah. Egypt is a very interesting example. I mean, Egypt is one of our largest aid recipients, not just for military aid, but all kinds of foreign aid. With Egypt, we actually withheld aid. This came after a couple of big things. One of the member states, a UN member state, which has asked to remain unidentified, so I don't know who it is either, actually interdicted a shipment of Scud parts coming into Egypt. That was the first straw. The second straw was when, I believe it was an Australian Navy ship, interdicted a ship that had 30,000 rocket-propelled grenades on it. Let me repeat that. 30,000 rocket-propelled grenades. The United States actually held back about $176 million worth of military aid for a couple of months until the Egyptians were able to prove that they had stopped. So those are two examples of what's happened in Africa. We actually have leverage on that continent with many of those countries because a lot of those countries have good relationships with the United States. These are countries that are our friends. So I think in Africa, as the United States chooses to push it, we're going to have the leverage to get them to stop buying from North Korea. Of course, the question then becomes, well, who do they buy their arms from then? because we charge a lot more for arms than the North Koreans do, us being Americans and NATO allies, Europeans, who would have to put them on new weapon systems, which in itself, switching to NATO systems would be very, very expensive. It's something we ran into after the Cold War when countries like the Czech Republic and Hungary and Poland joined NATO, which means their weapons had to be compatible with American weapons and French weapons, et cetera. So that'll be interesting to see how that evolves and how it gets settled. I'd like to make it very clear that is not going to be the case with the Middle East. The Iranians could care less if we tell them we're not giving you foreign aid. We don't give them any foreign aid. In fact, we have sanctions on them. And it's the same way with Yemen, Hezbollah, the Houthis, Hamas. There is nothing we can do short of violent interdiction to stop them from buying those weapons from the North Koreans, except, and this is very important, going after North Korea's illicit financial networks. Those hundreds of front companies in places like Malaysia alone, for example, the banks that are willing to launder dirty North Korean money, and all of the second country individuals that are willing to engage in these deals on behalf of the North Koreans so that the deals don't get a lot of attention, right? You're Korean, but you're not a North Korean, right? You're a Korean-American. So if you're negotiating a deal in Singapore on behalf of the North Koreans, you're not going to be a suspect as a guy who has a Pukan accent. See what I mean? And the North Koreans are very good at that. That's what we got to go after if we wanted to stop to the Middle East. Cut off the head and the body will collapse. And that is a big, expensive, resource-intensive, personnel-intensive undertaking. And so far, in my opinion, we haven't ramped it up as much as we could have. So let's see what happens in the future.
Right. I think for the reason you just mentioned, you have been relatively critical of the negotiations that have taken place to date with North Korea, between the United States and North Korea, including the six-party talks. Where do you see the fault here? Why did we not press them hard on this? Like, was it the lack of awareness? Where do you see the flaw in our negotiations to date?
How far back do you want me to go? KEI is a great place because, you know, when I was a really young professor and nobody knew who I was, KEI would invite me to stuff, and it gave me a great chance to get educated about what people were saying here in town who had real power and influence, right? So I remember coming here way, way back in 2008, and you guys had a discussion between a former Clinton official and a former Bush official, and they're pointing at each other saying, you screwed up. No, you screwed up. Well, actually, they both screwed up. I mean, this is not a partisan thing when it comes to policy failure. The Republicans and Democrats have both proved equally inept at organizing policy with the North Koreans. Whether it's Bill Clinton, who let them get away with having a highly enriched uranium program, whether it's the Bush administration, which in my mind screwed up worse than anybody else, and I'm a Republican. Really, really smart, proficient guys in the Bush administration, like David Asher and Bill Newcomb, who ran an interagency task force, were able to actually put North Korea on the ropes. They had squeezed the economy of North Korea to the point that the North Koreans were actually hurting. And one has to understand right off when you're starting to look at international security, you can't just say, this is my theory, this is my methodology, and it works everywhere. Just replace Milosevic with Kim Jong-un, and the theory will work perfectly. No! Geopolitics doesn't work like that. Sanctions is a good example of that. When we had the sanctions on Iran, they were working against the middle class. They actually have a middle class in Iran, kind of. You can't apply that paradigm to North Korea. The only way you're going to hurt the North Koreans and put pressure on them is by putting pressure on the elite. Kim Jong-un's inner circle and that 5 to 50,000 people who live in the best apartments in Pyongyang. That's it. That's the people you really need to put pressure on. And that's what they did in 2007 because the goods stopped coming in, fuel stopped coming in, the dirty money stopped being laundered. It worked. Well, what did they do? When the administration realized that they had actually got the North Koreans on the ropes, they gave them everything the North Koreans asked for, took them off the list of states supporting terrorism. You don't want to let us inspect your nuclear sites? Why do we need to inspect them? What the heck? We really screwed up. Obama did nothing. There was the famous leap year agreement, and then 2 weeks later, the North Koreans violated it, and then they just left them alone. So now here we are with Trump. And we hear a lot of people saying, well, I don't like the way this diplomacy's working and top-down instead of bottom-up, and this isn't going to go right. Why? Because all the other ways work so well? I think we need to give this a chance. I'm not real happy with what I see thus far, frankly, because they haven't really reached any agreements on specific nuclear stuff, on specific ballistic missiles, etc. When they do, we'll see what happens. But right now, they haven't screwed anything up yet. Let's give them a chance to actually screw it up before we start criticizing them.
Do you have any advice for negotiators going forward?
Well, the biggest piece of advice would be, and so far Donald Trump says he's going to do this, we don't take any pressure off. We keep the pressure on. And one hopes that pressure's on right now. We're not seeing a lot, but there may be a lot going on behind the scenes. You see what I'm saying? We keep that pressure on until North Korea completely denuclearizes under inspection. They have to dismantle their nuclear program and hopefully the platforms that carry it, the ballistic missiles, etc., completely, transparently, under inspection, which could be IAEA or us and the South Koreans, but it has to be done, and then we take the pressure off. Then we could start negotiating about other things, like their huge human rights violations, like their million-man army that's within 60 kilometers of Seoul, like their proliferation. In my mind, that would be the best advice. Very simple. You keep the pressure on until they do what they're supposed to do, and we get to inspect it.
And that's it for today's program. Many thanks to Dr. Bechtol for coming on the show, and to you for listening to Korean Context. Bruce Bechtol's new book, North Korean Military Proliferation in the Middle East and Africa, Enabling Violence and Instability, is available from the University Press of Kentucky and sold wherever good books can be bought. If you have any questions or comments, send us a tweet at KoreaEconInst. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe and rate us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Also, do check our Facebook page and tune in for both our events and our Facebook Live program, This Week in Korea, for an overview of developments in Korea every Monday at 2 p.m. See you there.
I'm guessing you weren't born yet in 1979, right?
No.
Okay.